Ever wondered what powers the world of your favorite superheroes? Dive into Understanding Superhero Comic Books, the definitive guide that unravels the mystery. It plunges into the captivating world of spandex, superpowers, and the masterminds who conceive them. Trace the origins and evolution of superhero comics, fueled by influences from Bela Lugosi's enigmatic charm, Errol Flynn's daring exploits, and the early mesmerizing magicians. Witness Batman, Wonder Woman, Captain America, and more as they navigate societal shifts, reflecting our world within their epic tales. Buy Alex Grand's Understanding Superhero Comic Books, available now.
Welcome back to the Comic Book Historians Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Grand. Today we have our next installment of the David Armstrong interviews. This is part two of his interviews with Nick Carty. Part one was filmed in 1998, and this one, part two, 7 years later in 2005. David Armstrong expands on some of the points Nick Carty made in the first interview, going further into detail into the Eisner Shop and Fiction House, as well as observations on other illustrators, more of his army experience, lessons in anatomy, science fiction stories, his Paris exhibit, design, page rates, his overall brushwork techniques, advertising, and his overall sense of religion. He also shares a funny experience at Comic-Con. We have David Armstrong to thank for the quality of these interviews. He recorded these in the highest quality available 20 plus years ago, which made it a real pleasure for me to digitize, remaster, edit, and to podcast format. David Armstrong, take it away.
When you first started at Eisner's shop, who was in the shop? Do you remember?
I remember showing my work to Eisner, and he looked at it, and while I was showing him the work, on the left-hand side or something on along the wall, it was Lou Fine, and then the desk next to him is George Tuska. There are some other people there that I couldn't see because of some obstruction. And there was another guy that's Charlie Sultan. I don't know if you ever heard of him. Mm-hmm. And from there, they sent me to Jerry Iger, which was a different place. And the next thing I knew, Chuck Mazuzin, who was doing Lady Luck, left, and Bill Eisner sent for me. And so when I went up there, Iger was getting $18.50. He called me over and he says, he had a lower puffed lip underneath. Whenever he talked, that lower was very pronounced. And he called me over and he says, come here. He says, you look in your pay envelope this week. And he was very happy about it. And it was a 50 cents raise that I got. So it was $18.50. Some of the guys I remember there at Jerry Iger's. And then from there, I went to Eisner. See.
And what did you work on then?
When I got to Eisner, I was working on Lady Luck. It was three pages that were the complete story. Four pages was, you see, some newspapers only printed those three pages, but there's some others that had to finish the stock or whatever it was in that extra page, and that was filled with action and maybe an extra scene talking, like a wind-up. But the story in itself was finished on three pages.
So you had to design a story that could either be three or four pages?
No. I took the story, the script, whatever I got, and I worked on it for the three pages. You see, then they said this: the filler page was a page that maybe in the last page, this villain comes after them, and the hero knocks them out. See, and then on the fourth page, the story's ended, so they go home. But as they turn around to come home down the dark alley, somebody attacks them. So the rest of the page is a fight. It doesn't mean anything, but it's that filler page, you see. At Eisner's, I was getting $25. And if you add that up, that it came up to about $4 a page. You could buy a very wealthy house for $20,000. And it was a big one, $40,000. That was after the war. Now, this was in 49, so you know what 10 cents could... You pick up pennies, and now you don't pick up pennies. You walk around, you don't bother. See? When you looked at it, Bill Eisner had all these contracts. He was doing the Spirit and some other jobs that we were farming out, you know? And so he did pretty good. Someone told me, I think by the age of 27 or 38, he had $100,000, but that's rumor. I can't prove that. That's nothing. But he was doing stories for Arnold, a Fiction House, And it was like a shop. And these kids didn't mind the work because they were sitting next to Lou Fine and these other guys, and they were learning. So they had no gripe. I had no gripe.
Did you find that work you did for Quality was different than the work you did for Fiction House, or was it basically the same?
Well, with Jerry Iger, well, then I was learning. I looked at that. It was learning. I got a little more polish when I finished Lady Luck. Then I went to a Fiction House. And I think when I left, Eisner wasn't really smiling, but I left. And then after that, Bob Powell left. I left and I went to Fiction House. And I remember John Salardo, Bob Lubers, and there was a guy that used to do the covers, Dal Nurovich.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Dal Nurovich.
And there's another guy called Gene Fawcett. So he used to love to do airplanes, that sort of thing.
He did a lot of Wings covers.
Yeah. And the thing was that at Christmas time, I went home with a bonus, and it was several hundred dollars. And I think that's when income tax became enforced. It was shortly after the war, wasn't it? The guy that owned the Fiction House gave all these guys bonuses, and we got a better wage than at Eisner. What I liked at Fiction House, they were also doing pulp magazines. And some of these pulp artists, one guy was doing some of these beautiful painting covers, and I wanted to be an illustrator. And I wasn't good enough, so I started with comics. The other guys copied all their favorites, Hal Foster, Alex Raymond, and at that time, nobody copied Kirby. But with me, the one that influenced me at the beginning was Hal Foster. And then from there, I took it from the illustrators, like, say, not Al Dorn, but some of the, there's some people that did some beautiful humor stuff, Earl Blossom. With the inking, I got influenced by Charles Dana Gibson. In those days, they didn't have too many color things. They were just starting with the magazine illustrations. So I used to clip every one that I could. And when you compared that to comics, that was so finished. But they had models posing for these things, you see. Hughes is doing that, and a few other people, they're doing the same thing. They're not comic artists. They're illustrators, because they use it.
Did the guys that you work with in the Eisner shop, did guys say, take a look at this, this is really great stuff? Or?
Oh, well, the only thing I remember, there was a guy that was Charlie Sultan. He drew the most beautiful cars, and I couldn't understand how he drew those beautiful cars. And later on, I found out that with the automobile ads, it cut them out and paste them in the comic thing. But his faces, say you had a face and he would draw the head, he put a cast shadow over the whole head and you see one eye looking. It was dramatic as hell, but he was cheating like hell too, you know. But it was very effective, but a lot of guys, I learned from different fellows, you know. And,
learning good stuff from the good guys?
Yeah, well, I try to pick the good stuff from the good guys. But I didn't pay too much attention to their work. Lou Fine, he was something in awe. He had such detail in his things. And I looked at his stuff later on. Well, his muscles weren't exactly accurate. And you look at Jack Kirby, forget his muscles, because He had very dramatic approaches to this thing. It's very dynamic and full of action. And you accepted the false muscles with the body, you know, because he had muscles where they didn't belong. And Neil Adams was one of the guys. He's a muscle guy. He knew everything. He tried to correct it, but they wanted Kirby, you know. If I wanted something to learn about muscles, the one that influenced me was Meyerbridge. You remember the guy that did the stopwatch? He had all the cameras at different things. And then you could see the muscle, the way it moves from the arm up here, going up in the shadow, the way it hits it. And you could see which muscles are working. And then if there were a weightlifting magazine, there were a page from a magazine, I would save that. I have a couple of pages of Schwarzenegger when he was in that universe competition or something. And they show front view, back view. At least I got the muscle. But now you find muscles anyway. You could get it on TV. But in those days, you had to do a hell of a lot of research. The illustrators, when they were illustrating something, the big painters like John Whitcomb, and there was an agency, if they needed some say, Western costumes, or if they want, whatever they want, they had this agency that went out, and they had tear sheets all over that give you all the stuff. You have to pay them. They give you all the stuff you want on a reference. I used one of their shops one time when I did a job, or when I did a movie poster. You go to this photographer, and you tell him what you want. You have your sketch. You make your sketches. You know the model to pose in a composition. And if there were four figures, I would get two models, a female and a male. The male would be in one position. Later on, I put him in another position. And then the female, I would do the same thing, only with one I make dark hair and blonde hair, you know. But it's, and there's a trick to copying photographs from illustrations that if you copy it, you know, just as you see it, and that's the way Hughes and a lot of guys do. They copy the actual photograph. The illustrators, they elongated the necks, they elongated the legs, they thinned their body, and they trimmed them to make it look like good models. Now, there's an artist that was Steve McManus. He did a lot of the 007 movie posters, and he did some beautiful women. And you could learn from it because they had a standard. Say a model figure is about five heads from one, two. And by that measurement, you could say where the breast ends, where the nipple begins. And then you go down so many heads to this point and down by the leg.
When you were in the Army during the war, did you have a sketch pad with you the whole time?
Yeah, really? I always carried. I had about five sketch pads. They were about 5x7 or something like that. And I used to make my sketches with a fountain pen. What was the famous name? Well, anyway, I had a fountain pen, and it wasn't waterproof. And I'd do my pen and inks with that. And then later on, if I wanted just a little tone of them, I'd just spit on my finger, rub it over, and get that smudge. And I did very few pencils, and I only inked on one side. So I had quite a few books on that, some parts that I remember from the action, and I made the sketch of the thing in the pad, the thing what happens, where the guys were blown off my tank, or when we were entrapped or something like that, or when we entered the church and the SS troopers were shot, that sort of thing.
When you talk to guys, cartoonists from your era who were in the war, there aren't many of them that were actually served in the fighting.
Very few.
Did you ever talk to, like, Jack Kirby or any of those guys who
no.
actually served in the...
Jack Kirby? I didn't know that.
He was served in the infantry. He actually...
Yeah. Well, I started in the infantry on the 66th Division. That's when they formed the division, and I designed their Panther patch. I still have it home. But that division, I got transferred to the tank division, the 3rd Armored Division.
But everyone I talked to, you know, Erwin Hazen...
Yeah, nobody
all these
knew
guys,
it. No.
They drew. They got stuck in Fort... Dicks, or they never went overseas.
I heard of Will Eisner doing that thing for the Army, and I wrote him a letter. Even though I left him, I felt embarrassed writing him a letter, so maybe he can help me get back into the thing, and he didn't.
You still have the sketchbooks.
I have the sketchbooks. I have a lot of watercolors. I have some scenes. I have quite a few sketches, scenes of Paris and V-Day. And when I had something in my foot, I was on a crutch, and we were looking out the window where the rockets were firing, and that was in pen and ink, and I had my foot raised. So a Red Cross woman came. She looked at the sketches. She says, oh, can I borrow these? We're right in Paris. She met an exhibit, and I know there was an exhibit in Paris, but I didn't see it. I was still in the hospital. See.
After you got out of the war, in the 50s, when you went back to work to D.C., you did science fiction stories. I mean, you did almost every kind of story there was, except for superhero stories, right?
They never gave me superhero stories.
Were you okay with that? Was it fun drawing science fiction stories?
Well, I tell you what. Well, it didn't bother me in a sense. While I was doing comics for D.C., I was making my portfolio for illustration. The only trouble with that, it took too long to do the portfolio. I did Leonard Bernstein conducting, but where his arm was here with the baton, I do another arm, another arm. In other words, if he's going this way, his arm is up and he's going down, he's conducting. And it was just that picture. Then I did another one of Pablo Casals. I was going classical. I was going Pablo Casals with his bow, and I made it like a stained glass window where he was going different motions of his hand that was going up and down with the bow. And then I did Stravinsky with his Firebird, and I did abstract images, like, you know, and then the Firebird around it. And that was a painting. After I did those, 7-Up came with an ad of illustrations done by Bob Peak, who was the top artist at the time. And he did these basketball players running. You could see the hands going this way, different hands of motion of the feet. And I figured if I ever showed my samples to an advertising agency, they would think I copied him. So I never showed those. See, so I have quite a few, about 50 or so illustrations that never went anywhere. See, I did pastels, caricatures. I have one of Jackie Gleason that was in a book with the, you know, the guy he played with the big tall hat and all that. See, so
when you were working for DC, you did a lot of covers for them. Were you working for Carmine, or who were you working for?
I was doing covers all along, but it wasn't in a steady stream. The people that were doing Superman or Batman did the covers. I did the House of Mystery. I did those covers. When Batlash was through, I was no longer doing Teen Titans, and I was no longer doing Aquaman, but they had me doing some mystery stories. Then they had me doing plop-type things, and it got to the jobs as more like whatever jobs were available, and I lost interest in that. And then Carmine got me to do the covers, and that was shortly after Batlash, and so I made a whole run on the things for about 2 years or so. But with Carmine, I'll say this in all honesty, he's always loved my work, and he couldn't find any fault with it. And so if he made a layout, Carmine felt, because of his influence for boosting the sales for DC, that his covers did the job. So he went ahead and did the layouts. But with me, he's very flexible. He'd do a layout, and I would say, well, that's great. Let me play around with this. I'll play around and bring him back. I said, I moved this over. The general idea is there, but I think it would be a better design if we move it this way, but still have the action. It's more eye-catching. Eliminate this and eliminate that. He says, great, go ahead. One or two covers he liked so much, he became like a ham actor. If he liked someone carrying a dead person, he liked it so much that he did it with Superman, then he did it with Aquaman, then he did it, you know, he sort of repeats things. And then he had a way of some of his covers that he would do them at an angle. Sometimes it had a streets at an angle. It was dramatic, but after a while you knew it was Carmine's angle. And later on, he gave me a lot more headway. And this way, I would design the cover to fit what the action was going to be. But the thing was, I didn't know, and today I don't know, if the covers were based on what was inside the book.
I mean, were you aware of the fact that the cover sold the book, and that you were doing a lot more covers than you were interiors, and they were only...
Oh, yeah, I was doing a lot of covers. And did you ever see the covers where they have one center splash, then they have a few columns going around with all the superheroes, and some of them two extra panels on the bottom? It happened a lot with the Justice League. So when it got to these things, it was just a job of filling in. But when I designed the cover, I designed them for maximum impact. In other words, if they were on a newsstand, you only had about 3 seconds to look at these things. And you had to do that because there are a lot of competition out there, unless you went strictly for the name. But even then, if you saw something that hit you, right, if you had 100 people there on a cover, that's a little confusing. But if you hit them with the one spot, you see. Julie Schwartz used to say, if you put a gorilla on the cover, it will sell. Some other guys had some other fetish about these things, you know. To him, whenever he looked at these gorilla covers, it went. He had me do a gorilla cover one time where all the gorillas were on the jury and the attorneys were questioning the gorilla. They had a Congo Bill where these gorillas were in the jungle. Did you know there was a writer named Miller? I think his name is Jack Miller. I'm not sure. And in Congo Bill, I only did 7 issues. I think 7 issues was the gauge where they can find out if it's sold or not. So in one of the issues prior to this, I had done quite a bit of Tarzan stuff, and I went to the Museum of Natural History to make sure I didn't put a monkey from South America in Africa, that sort of thing. No tigers in Africa or stuff. And I did a lot of research. So in one of the pages, he had Congo Bill was standing behind some bushes, and they couldn't get across the plain, and he tells his sidekick, he says, jump on the hyena and get help. That's the fastest animal in the jungle. So I try to tell him, hyena isn't the fastest animal. It's a cheetah. What difference does it make, you know? And after that, I didn't argue with him. In the next page, they're making this trip, and they can't cross the plain because there's a rhinoceros there. And he says, let's wait. This rhinoceros is charging his favorite meat, the zebra. And I try to tell him, you know, a rhinoceros is herbivorous. It doesn't eat that sort of thing. He said, what do you, you know, you find, I let it go, but I got all the fan mail saying, what about, you know, the cheetah's the fastest animal. The kids were smarter than the rhino was.
But the stuff you did, you were very specific in how you laid it out so that you focused attention on the dramatic moments.
Yes.
And not, then did you, when you designed it, did you use proportions and be able to focus in on
what I did, like say, for example, very roughly, if you wanted to do something very religious or very classic, you go with like the big columns, do it in the big column form, put a big column, put everything around, trees and everything right around that, trees going up. That makes it very regal, or a church or something like that. But if you want some action, you put it on a diagonal. You make your action go in that direction. But when you listen to music of Beethoven, did you ever hear that thing where it goes, ba 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 ba, all right? But in between it goes, ba 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 ba, ba 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 ba, ba. So, you have one angle, then you have the little angles that go behind it, see? But the big angle stays there, so I try to put my figures that way. And I made a movie poster, The Street Fighter. And that was figures fighting, but they were exploding from the center. A leg was going this way. It's like a splash, you see? And those things catch the eye. I did one of Aqualad punching Robin and on the cover. And the other Teen Titans was standing flat behind, see. So I tried to get the effect of an arrow hitting a wall, an impact. And to make the impact more powerful, I left the figures very steady. And I didn't put any background. I left it white because any building would have slowed down the action of that arrow. See? And I did a lot of my covers that way for the simplicity of it and impact, see.
Did you realize that you were helping increase their sales and you weren't getting any more money?
I wasn't getting it. Did I tell you this story? I went up to, I didn't know until I saw it in the Hall of Fame, you know, in the convention, that this, the publisher died. What's his name?
Erwin Donenfeld.
Well, George Cashton was my editor at the time doing the Teen Titans. So I said, is there any way of getting a pay raise in on the pages? He says, you've been here quite a while now. And I had done Aquaman. I had done Daniel Boone. I had all these other, there's seven series, you know. He says, come on, let's go to see Donenfeld. So we went in there. Donenfeld was very quiet and he looked. He says, well, you know, we're trying to get rid of a lot of deadwood around here, you know. And he was in the, and he says, I can't do it. It's a lot of deadwood. So, then I got pissed off because he sort of brushed me off and, so he didn't even want to think about it. So then what happened was that I left and I said, the Lex job, the Teen Titan job, I'm going to do the Christmas issue. I'm going to do a bang-up job, and then I'm going to quit. And then I told that to Carmine. And Carmine said, don't quit because there are going to be big changes. And that's where he became the editor. And that's where he went. But I don't remember if I got a raise on paper.
But, I mean, it's amazing when you consider how important the covers were and how much they influenced the sales of the books.
You go somewhere, you see a painting. It's so busy that you don't know what to watch first. All right. I've seen Neil Adams and a lot of the other artists that they do a splash page, like say, and there's buildings in the background. Mm-hmm. All right. Say one arm is this way, up ready to strike or fend off a strike. All right. Here's the figure. All right, so the arm is this way. Then, while you're inking that arm, they put the corner of the building at the same angle as that arm, and you lose the arm. You see, a lot of illustrators used to say, when you make a group, make a silhouette out of it. And then I used to put a lot of air around it to separate it from the other people, or make the lines with a pen line. You could create perspective. A heavy line brings it closer to the fine. So I used to put that separation. But with the younger guys, they don't do that. So I used to call Perez the Cecil B. DeMille of the comics, because he had a cast of thousands.
Every panel's
at thousands of heads, you know. And it's great if you like heads, you know. But I like simple things. The reason I learned from Robert Fawcett, he was an illustrator. Do you remember him? Mm-hmm. He had a scene of the fight for the Alamo. And in the scene, he had a lot of figures. But he had two central figures, a Mexican and an American, fighting diagonally right in the close-up on the page. So you knew what was going on. And the rest were different repetitions of that angle inside. But they were smaller. But you knew that fight was going. And that's the simplicity that I'm talking about.
You're paying $150, $200 for a cover in those days, weren't you?
I got about $65 or $60 or $65. This was in 72 or 3, around there, see. And then I took one of my covers, this house that does the auction, you know, the big one in Texas. And they had a Wonder Woman that was strapped to a bomb that was being dropped on New York City. And they sold that for $9,000. Then they sold about $23,000 worth of my work. And I looked at the listings of the different articles, and I figured out what I got for each. And I think for the total of the articles that they sold there, and what I added up, what the price I got for those items must have been $300 to $400 at the time, you know.
So an investment in Nick Hardy art would probably be good.
It would now, but I booked to my wife. I told you, we were divorced in 68, so we speak every week. We talk to each other. I only talk so long, because after a while, the closet door opens, and I don't want to get involved in that, you know. And I told her about this, and she says, "Gee, Nick, you work so hard for that, you know." And she was my best fan. She loved my inking work. Oh, she's great.
Do you draw every day?
No. No, I don't. I was never money hungry in the money sense. I was trying to improve myself. And I think through the years, the only way I felt that I was improved, when Gil Kane, you know, every artist is trying to find his style or whatever it was. And Gil Kane came in one time. He says, "I saw your drawing." He says, I said, "How do you know it's my drawing?" He says, "Oh, I could tell you, girls. I could tell you," he could tell everything. And people came in, they could identify myself. And I didn't know I had anything to identify. And they let me know that I had a style, see. And so, but I changed it after that too, you know, as I kept going. And, but it was a process of learning. When they start bouncing them around, each job I did, I was interested. If it was Daniel Boone, I'll do research because I'm an early American history buff. I like the Revolutionary War when it started. So that was interesting because I put early American facts into it. If it was at the jungle, I do fabulous, a lot of research.
I also noticed that your brushwork got much more refined in the late 60s and early 70s. Oh, yeah. As you control a line, you ended up getting more depth in your stuff because of the thickness and the thinness of the line.
Yeah, well, the thing with that was that at first I was using the brush to do the whole contour of the thing. And if you had a fine brush, you got a fine line on the side that isn't lit. And the shadow side, I use a heavy brush. Then I found that if I make a very loose pencil, I get the figure and the lines. Then I would take an old brush, not a new one. Before I did anything else, I put the black with the hair. I put the black under the chin, a little under the nose. It depends on how much lighting I want. And I put a black along the side. And everything that had to be black. And then I would do the secondary lines, the ones that weren't that thick, that bridged the black, to keep the light going consistent on one side. And then I use a very fine pen just to hook everything together, see. And that made it quicker. and it made it more like a painting.
You got far more depth.
I think it all boiled down. All the things that I was working for through the years culminated in my final line that I was satisfied. And the work was very simple. If it was dramatic, I put heavy shadows. If it wasn't dramatic, I made it as simple as possible so it could tell a story. And when I was satisfied with that, it was, you know. But then when there was no stories that were interesting, I lost interest in the artwork. See? But I tell you, I went to advertising and I did layouts for movie posters. So they had me do a layout for a movie poster. Say it was Casey's Shadows. I made a rough sketch for a poster this big in pencil. And I did a couple of layouts like that. And I put all the characters. They give you what you call, what is a sheet that shows all the pictures on one side? What is that, a composite?
Yeah.
And you pick the faces that you look for. And since I cut competition when I was going to sell my work, when I looked at all the illustrators, they all use models and photographs. And so since I didn't use that, I cut my odds. I went toward the slight caricature side. There weren't too many that were doing that, see. So most of my stuff leaned toward the light side. And I didn't do severe caricatures like Hirschfeld, which I thought he was great. I did a movie poster for Gemini. It was a play on Broadway. The producers and everybody liked it. But the girl that played the lead part, she said, I don't like being on a lamp line. There were telephone poles.
Yeah.
The thing of this was they're climbing to the
telephone pole,
and they had a big cake on it that said Gemini, and she was reaching for it. And then her second lead was down, going down the ladder, and the backyard was a backyard. But she didn't like the idea of straddling a pole. I'm not going to straddle, or something like that. Madeline Kahn was the one. And so they canceled that. Talking about the layout that I did for Casey Ruggles, I did the layout. I did two for them. I spent a couple of days. I got $2,000 for that. Just a little rough sketch. I said, Jesus Christ, I've been in the wrong business a long time. And I did quite a few layouts for them. When they started the first Superman, I made the pencil layouts for them. Two companies I worked the Superman layouts. These were just very quick sketches, and that's the simplicity that I'm talking about.
Now, think about coming back to conventions and seeing what everyone thinks about your work and all that stuff.
This girl wants to meet you. Came all the way down from Boston, and she had a sweet face, and she says, oh, yes, I'm a fan of yours. I said, you draw? She says, oh, yeah. Oh, I love your work. I copied everything I could find. And then I said, do you have any art with you? So she took the art book, gave me a book, and I opened it up, and it was hardcore pornography in color. But she did her hair the way I did my hair. You know, I said, my God, what have I created? But her name is Mercy Van Flack. At the last time I was in Charlotte, she came up and she said, how are you? And the guy with the beard that introduced me. And I think they produced their own pages. And they put them together and they put a plastic. Had she come with purple hair or red makeup or a ring through her nose or ears, I would say, I don't know what to expect here. But this girl has such a Lillian Gish type face, you know. And you open it up and you see this in color, arms strapped up and everything, you know. Then I ran with the book to show it to Dick Giordano, which was an artist alley. I had a special booth with Spencer Beck. And as I got there, I was about to show him, and she had a table, a booth right next to him, and I had a big following.
So did you get religion after that?
No, I never had religion. I got
Italian if you...
I was never a good religious person, because I tell you, during this, I don't want, this is a war story, I don't want to go through it. Okay.